We live above on the land. Others live below in the sea. And we are connected at every depth. I am Suzanne Lang, bringing you a novel idea. We may stand on the shore or the deck of a boat, but most of us are disconnected from the habitat, the resources, and life within the oceans. Today we visit with some people who have worked to synthesize information, so we don't have to, who bring science and art and culture and biology all in frames that we can engage with. Tessa Hill and Eric Simmons have together written At Every Depth. That takes us from the tide pools along the coast to the ocean's deepest depths and tells us of the people who continue to build connection to the seas, scientists, aquatic cultivators, and indigenous people whose historic practices can lead us to a more sustainable future. We'll talk with Tessa Hill in just a moment. The Mysterious World of Bull Kelp is a web story online at bullkelp.info that uses design and narrative to take us on a journey to the depths and helps us understand the kelp forest ecosystem along with its challenges. Josie Islin and Mariana Loyschel are the co-founders of Above Below, an ocean literacy campaign that's created this web story. And through smart web design, beautiful graphics, and clear, informative language, the kelp forest community along the Pacific coast all the way up to Alaska comes alive. Stay with us as we aim to build our connection with the ocean. It's a novel idea. Oceanographer Tessa Hill joins us. She teaches at UC Davis and is based at the Bodega Marine Lab in Northern California. Tessa researches the oceans and climate change. Eric Simmons is a science writer and longtime editor of Bay Nature magazine. Together, they've written At Every Depth, Our Growing Knowledge of the Changing Oceans. In their book are profiled many people with various relationships to the oceans, scientists, curious citizen scientists, and indigenous peoples who've made their homes along the coast since well before Europeans arrived here. The book contains a lot of science, but presented in such a way that it is not only accessible to us, but illustrates linkages between all that is being observed in the marine environment by those who are looking. So much of what exists in the ocean is mostly invisible to us. At Every Depth is structured somewhat spatially, from the shoreline to the ocean depths to the polar regions, all to make the invisible visible. Here is our conversation.
People look out at the sort of expanse of the blue ocean, and they imagine that nothing is changing inside of that blue expanse. On the other hand, when we turn and we look in our own backyards and our communities on land, we recognize that there's a tremendous amount of environmental change happening. So I think so many of us can recognize changes in weather and climate, in wildfires, in droughts, in, you know, very hard, big rainstorms. We see a lot of everyday examples of how much change has happened. And Eric and I started talking about what would it be like to try to tell a story of those kinds of things, wildfires, for example, the equivalent of that happening in the ocean. How can we build a human connection to those things so that people see how much is changing? At its very core, the book is about how connected we all are as humans to the ocean. We have a very long evolutionary history of being connected to the ocean. And sometimes maybe we forget about that or we get a little disconnected. And so I think Eric and I were trying to tell stories that rekindled that connection. And we did that sort of in a couple different ways. And one is that we went out into the world and asked people who know the ocean really well. So that's scientists, it's people who live along the coast, it's indigenous communities, indigenous knowledge holders, fishermen, conservation groups. We asked for them to tell us what they see in their changing ocean. And we also sort of took a walk through the ocean, through a set of different environments. And we start with the one that might be the easiest for people to sort of enter and see and understand, you know, right at the shore, the tide pools. But we move deeper and further offshore and eventually into polar worlds and then the deep sea. So places that maybe everyday people don't get a lot of exposure to or a window into, but there are people who can tell us about how much those places are changing too.
You mentioned all the people you spoke with, and I felt that this book was as much about people as about the oceans. You talk of the incredible work of the curious people and scientists and the indigenous peoples who've made their homes along the coast since well before Europeans came. And you include the work of citizen scientists. So what I felt like you were doing there was by infusing your narrative with these people and their reflections and their observations really did help build a kind of a network and community, and that you even include the work of non-scientists and like I said, these citizen scientists really even further makes that connection amongst people.
Eric and I made a conscious decision at the beginning, which we actually never tell the reader, but you clearly understood it. So I'm so happy to hear that we hold these different types of knowledge to be of equal value. So we gain a tremendous amount of insight from Western scientific knowledge, but we also gain so much insight from people who have lived and worked and thrived along the shoreline for their whole lives, or maybe even through generations and centuries, or in the case of indigenous communities, they've lived along these shorelines for thousands of years. And there's so much for all of us to understand by listening to those stories. And so I do think, you know, our goal with the book was really to forefront stories, to tell good stories that would help people feel connected to the ocean. So it's not a textbook. It doesn't cover everything in the ocean. We certainly made choices about what to highlight and what not to highlight. But we were trying very hard to tell you something about these amazing people who are observing so much change. And I think there's a couple of things that sort of bubble to the surface when we listen to those stories. And one of those is that people who are observing the coast and the ocean change are seeing it change so rapidly, and they're able to articulate, you know, what we're losing, what we have, what is at stake, what we need to fight for. They're also able to articulate what brings them hope and what they are doing to fight for, you know, our thriving and sustainable lives along the coast. I think another thing that really bubbled to the surface for both Eric and I as we were doing these interviews is that whether it's a scientist or someone who lives along the coast, you know, a community member who's contributing to science or someone who's working hard to improve our sustainable management of the coast, or a fisherman or someone who's working in sustainable aquaculture, for example, any of these folks, it takes a tremendous amount of bravery at this point to continue doing what they are doing in the face of so many challenges. And so I think Eric and I really left those interviews with such a sense of honor to be in those spaces where people would share their stories with us, but also a sense of admiration for people who continue to be willing to make these observations, to tell us about what's changing, to try to tell the whole world about what's changing, and to tell us what to fight for and how to fight. Because any one of those people could make a decision to turn away and do something else and ignore what's in front of them, which is hard and challenging and sad. But all of these folks that we talk to in the book are making the daily choice to keep observing and keep connecting to the ocean.
You just mentioned people involved in aquaculture, and you address fishing and overfishing, which in some cases has shut down fisheries entirely. And you also talk about the cultivated and sustainable harvesting of fish and other aquatic animals practiced along Tomales Bay domestically, but also by islanders and coastal inhabitants, that they've been practiced, as you just alluded to. Their culture has been using a managed form of cultivation for hundreds and hundreds of years that perhaps has been intentionally marginalized, just like their language has been marginalized, nearly out of existence. And now we are looking to these practices again. So I wonder if you could talk a little bit about that.
Yeah, I mean, I completely agree with what you just said. It's so interesting thinking about, this is a really good example where Western scientists have so much to learn from indigenous knowledge holders who have been managing sustainable harvests along the coast for millennia. And we were able in one of the chapters to tell the story about clam gardens in the Pacific Northwest and the sort of quote unquote discovery of clam gardens by scientists, when of course indigenous knowledge holders knew about them all along. So they didn't really need to be discovered. And we also were able to talk with conservation and sustainable management groups in Hawaii who are thinking about revitalizing, you know, fish ponds and indigenous ways of sustainably harvesting and managing fish stocks. And it's really interesting thinking about just how much there is to learn from the past, and also how relevant that is for looking forward. I think one of the fun things about those interviews for Eric and I is that when we would mention to the folks that we feature in the Clam Gardens chapter, when we mentioned to them that we were talking to the people in the fish ponds chapter, they all know each other. So, which is probably not a huge surprise, but there is a wonderful and inspiring exchange of knowledge going on right now. And I think that's very central to the book, is people sharing knowledge with each other in ways that's different, or different types of knowledge. And, you know, having our eyes opened to that, and how does it change the choices we might make about the ocean moving forward?
We seem to have, over the years of European settlement of this continent, have thought that the seas are abundant and plentiful and inexhaustible in their supply of what they can give to us, the humans on land. And this isn't just with the ocean. I mean, you brought up forest fires. Forest management is another example but people who got their food sources and livelihood from the ocean for hundreds of years, we were mistaken to think it was because it was easy for the picking and there was plenty of it, so they didn't have to worry about it or have any kind of practices. They created their own abundance, and we never really saw that, and we still don't really see it.
Yeah, one of the scientists that we talked to in that Clam Gardens chapter, his name is Doug Duer, and he makes that explicit point both in interviews with us as well as in his papers, that there was this mischaracterization of how Indigenous people in the Pacific Northwest lived and thrived. And there has been this myth that has been, you know, said over and over again in our sort of Western white culture that it was easy because of abundance. And some of what's really exciting about the science, the blend of Western science and Indigenous knowledge that has resulted in a lot of understanding about those clam gardens is that we can see now and we can understand now through a Western science lens that by setting up these gardens where Indigenous people and tribes were basically creating conditions that were ideal for clams to live, cleaning off the sand and keeping it all of sort of the right size and the right height and the right slope on the beach and creating these barriers around the gardens so that the, you know, the clam area was sort of protected, we can now see that they were actually producing, you know, more in terms of quantity of clams than you could get on just a plain sort of uncontrolled beach. And so it wasn't about, you know, a mysterious level of abundance that made life easy. It was work and it was careful management. And actually, I shouldn't use the word was because it still goes on today. So this is work. It's careful management. It's done through thousands of years of shared knowledge about how to sustainably harvest foods in a way that is sort of minimally impactful on the environment around the garden. I think it really challenges that notion that, you know, and the same with the Hawaiian fish ponds idea, it really challenges the notion that Indigenous people were just living in a tremendously abundant landscape. They were managing the land and the sea. They are managing the land and the sea today. And I think science has so much to learn from that.
Much of the book highlights the changing temperature of the oceans, most certainly caused by human-induced climate change. And you tell us that in 25 years, from 1997 to 2022, carbon dioxide in the atmosphere has risen from 360 parts per million to 420 parts per million. And you mentioned the heat wave of 2014 through 2016 that had devastating and rippling effects. And in fact, 90% of Northern California kelp forests were killed. And I know that the kelp forests have sort of an interesting role in the whole ecosystem, along with other animals who call that area home. So talk a little bit about ocean temperatures and specifically some of what you saw in our very recent times here.
It's a wonderful question because I think one could argue that that heat wave was a pivotal moment in Eric and I deciding to write the book. It's actually how we met. He was interviewing me for a story that was during that time period, and it's how we started corresponding about the book. So yeah, in general, you know, we're seeing the way climate change is proceeding in the ocean is that, you know, it's can be very variable. So it's not happening exactly the same everywhere, but we are seeing these changes in surface ocean temperature. So it's getting warmer and warmer. And you can sort of imagine, you know, tropical species are able to expand their range. So we're seeing in the Northern Hemisphere, for example, on the California coastline, we see this northward march of species that we might have associated with being, you know, originally used to live further south. And that compresses, you know, all these species are sort of the species that can move are starting to move northward. And you can imagine that in polar areas like the Arctic, you know, you eventually get to a place where you can't move any further north. So then what we see is real compression of, you know, organisms coming into those habitats that haven't been seen before. And the animals that are native to those habitats are having to adjust or adapt to changing temperatures. But one of the very first stories that we tell in the book is essentially about that northward march. And it's about a paper that was published in the 90s that was able to document that northward march of species. And it's based in a study that was done in a tide pool off Hopkins Marine Station in Monterey. And a group of scientists there were able to compare to a baseline study that had been done decades before and to sort of look backward about who and what used to live in these tide pools and how has that changed today. You know, what was interesting is we were researching that story and we were doing interviews for that story basically around that same time that that heat wave in 2013 to 2016 was still going on. We were seeing organisms sort of march north. And so we could look back at this study that was from the 90s that actually compared to, you know, marine species that had been documented decades before. And then we could turn around and ask scientists right in that time in 2016, 2017, 2018, well, what are you seeing today? And, you know, what we heard over and over again is, you know, we're seeing, you know, this particular kind of nudibranch or this particular kind of anemone or this particular kind of snail, which never used to live in this place of the coastline. I'm now seeing it in my field site. And so, you know, whether or not we want to accept it or believe it, these marine ecosystems are changing. They're adapting to a changing climate. And some of those organisms can adapt and can move, and some can't really, and are really susceptible to the heat. And actually the kelp is a good example of that. So that what we see in these kelp die-offs, there's several different factors that play a role in the decline of kelp in California over the last decade. But one of those significant factors is the temperature of the ocean. And when the temperature of the ocean is warm enough, crosses a threshold, it's very hard for those kelp forests to continue to thrive. And so much of what we sort of imagine as characteristic of the California coast is actually connected to those kelp forests. So we're losing a habitat that feels, you know, very fundamental to what we think of when we think about strolling along the California coast and what organisms are there, you know, sea otters and things like that. We're losing the, you know, the fundamental habitat that supports those animals.
I'm trying to recall the term in the book. Was it urchin barrens?
That's correct.
Yes. So can you tell us a little bit about urchin barrens?
With the kelp forest example, I alluded to the fact that there are several different factors that are important. And with the kelp forest in California, there's been sort of a perfect storm of challenges. So there was this heat wave that you and I referred to. And during and shortly after that heat wave, there was a pathogen that caused an outbreak in sea stars. And so many of the sea stars along the California, Oregon, and Washington coasts were susceptible to this disease. And we saw sort of catastrophic loss in sea star populations. Some of them have bounced back. But in the case of the sunflower sea star, which is a major predator, on the seafloor off of the California, Oregon, Washington, all the way up to Alaska, the sunflower sea star did not bounce back. So still really massive decline in populations and of that sea star. And it is moving towards being listed on the endangered species list. So we saw this really significant decline in sea star populations, and sea stars actually consume baby urchins when they're little. So these big giant sea stars actually eat and attack and keep the sea urchin populations sort of in check. And then sort of the next step in this to think about is that the sea urchins really like to eat kelp. It's their favorite food, and they will mow it down like a lawnmower. So you can imagine there's sort of a series of dominoes that I just set up for you. We had this heat wave that like stressed the kelp forests and may have stressed the sea stars enough that this pathogen was able to take hold. There's still a lot of information that we're still trying to understand about the disease and the sea stars. We don't have it all worked out, but we had this big die-off in the sea star populations. And so then no one is around to keep the urchin populations in check because the sea stars are not there eating them. So the urchins really exploded and they began consuming a tremendous amount of kelp. And they actually can eat so much kelp that, like you referred to, this ecosystem on the seafloor will be created. It's called an urchin barren. It's basically, you can see that there used to be kelp there. So there's sort of the little like root structure where the kelp is attached to the rock. And there might be a little bit of the stalk of the kelp sticking out. But then all you see is sort of the seafloor carpeted by sea urchins because they have eaten all of the leafy kelp material. And with that many sea urchins present, it's pretty difficult for the kelp to make a recovery. And so the recovery efforts in California, the state of California has been working tremendously hard at this. And it's, you know, involved some combination of restoration efforts to try to replant and support the kelp itself, but also to remove the urchin. So there's been a lot of effort in Northern and Southern California to try to remove the urchins, you know, having divers go down there and collect them or smash them. But I'll just circle back. I mean, one of the things that's hard about this is that until we contend with the overarching problem, which is the rising temperatures in the ocean, which is caused by climate change, human-caused climate change. You know, all of these efforts that we're making to restore the kelp forest ecosystems are going to be limited in their success, frankly.
You also, in the book, discuss corals quite a bit and help us understand the dynamic going on that is affecting these beautiful creatures and compromising the ecosystem that they support. You call coral a foundation species. And I think, again, some of us don't even really realize what a coral is, maybe because we've just bought pink souvenirs at, you know, a curio shop, but that they really are animals and they really play a pivotal role. And I wonder if you could just spend a few minutes talking about coral.
I would love to. And it's a good segue to think about foundation species, because when scientists talk about foundation species, we're talking about species that literally produces a foundation where other things can grow and thrive. And so it creates, you know, homes and spaces for other organisms. And we do have, when we think about foundation species along the California coast, we often talk about things like mussels, which are creating, you know, the mussels growing along the shore create all these sort of nooks and crannies and crevices for other things to live in. And in tropical environments, the foundation species, one of the foundation species would be the coral. So corals, as you said, are a colonial animal. There are a whole bunch of animals that are essentially living together. They build a hard exoskeleton, which is basically a shell. It's made out of the exact same material or very similar material that oysters and mussels make their shells out of. Corals come in, you know, many different shapes and sizes and often can form reefs. So we think about reefs as sort of being a whole collection of those corals all found together. And so you can imagine an environment that it's very colorful. Those corals have lots of interesting colors. There's a lot of different nooks and crannies, shapes that, you know, fish can hide in, or an eel could be tucked back in the crevice, or there's a sponge that maybe would be attached to the side of a coral. And so the coral reef itself, that hard structure that's composed of all those little colonial organisms, is actually creating a habitat for other organisms. And one of the things we try to feature in the book is that corals themselves are threatened by several different things. One of the things we've already talked about, and that's changing temperature. So a lot of corals have sort of an upper temperature limit where they can successfully live and thrive. And, you know, there's always exceptions to that. You'll find places where corals are living in unusually warm conditions. But when we talk and sort of, you know, broad brushstrokes about healthy coral habitats, you know, that have a lot of diverse species and different types of corals and all those different shapes that we talked about, usually as temperatures rise and reach kind of a threshold where the corals are, you know, no longer able to thrive, we start to see some evidence of stress. And you probably have heard about this before. One of those pieces of evidence of stress are bleaching events. So the coral has a symbiont that lives in it. And the symbiont is a species of algae. So there's like a little plant-like thing living inside of the animal, and they live symbiotically. So they are essentially, you know, happy living alongside one another. They each benefit a little bit from living next to each other. So the algae benefits a little bit from being next to the coral, and the coral benefits a little bit from sharing its home with the algae. But when you stress the corals and you take them above a certain temperature threshold, oftentimes what happens, they get stressed, they get unhappy. And oftentimes what happens is that those symbionts end up expelled or sort of kicked out. And so when we see pictures of, you know, bleached white reefs where the corals are no longer colorful, that doesn't actually mean that the corals are all dead. It means that that perfect relationship, that symbiotic relationship, is no longer thriving. And the algal symbionts have left, and the coral is trying to survive on its own. Some of those corals will, if the temperatures decrease back to a comfortable position, will be fine. They will recover their symbionts. They'll get new symbionts, and they will go back to being, you know, their beautiful colors and looking like they did before. But part of what we see with an increasing intensity of those bleaching events and duration of those bleaching events and frequency of those bleaching events, so as they get, they're coming faster, those bleaching events are lasting longer, and they're happening more frequently and more intensely. And so we're seeing coral reefs in some cases actually die back completely under those heated, superheated conditions. And then I guess the other thing good to tell you about is something I've done quite a bit of work on in my research here on the California coast, which is about ocean acidification. And so ocean acidification is fundamentally the change in chemistry of the ocean water because of how much carbon dioxide we have put into the atmosphere. So the fundamental cause is the same as climate change. So through human activities, through the burning of fossil fuels, and through changes in how we use land, through agriculture and other purposes, so basically through industrial and agricultural choices that we've made, we've put a lot of extra carbon dioxide into the atmosphere. And the ocean is a tremendous sponge for that carbon dioxide. So it actually soaks up about 30% of what we put in the atmosphere ends up staying in the ocean, not in the atmosphere. And it has significantly changed the chemistry of the ocean. And the way that I want to connect this back to corals for you is that it has changed that material that I told you about, that oysters and mussels and corals build their shell material out of. The chemistry of the ocean has changed such that it's harder for those organisms to build that shell material. So we actually are starting to see some evidence of shells dissolving because the chemistry is too corrosive for those shells to be stable. And so we see that as a second threat on top of warming that is harming corals. So the corals right now are dealing with, you know, several different stressors, temperature being a major one. And you see these bleaching events, but we also see evidence that the change in chemistry of the ocean is actually making it hard for those coral animals to actually build their hard parts. And that, you know, is pretty fundamental to the whole system. It's hard to imagine a healthy coral reef without that hard structure.
You know, Tessa, in the book, you talk about how seasoned researchers were left speechless and often in tears when they return to an underwater area they thought they knew and then find nothing living. And that gets to the point of what you're talking about. When these things don't have the right chemistry and temperature to survive, they die. And you also point out that we just don't have the luxury of time for even long-range studies because things are changing so fast.
Yeah, that particular story that you just hinted at is No, I think one of the most powerful ones in the book, it features that part of the chapter features Kim Cobb, who's now at Brown University, and she has worked in these reefs in the Pacific for decades, for her whole career, her whole scientific career. And she tells a story about going back during one of these really extreme heat waves and jumping off the boat to go dive in this reef that she has been to dozens, maybe more than dozens of times. She's been there for years and years and years. She just told us that it felt like that she could describe the place like it was her neighborhood. She knew it like the back of her hand. And she dives into the water, and it is disorienting because she cannot recognize anything that is there because there's so little left. There's this tremendous amount of urgency, both in her story and really throughout the entire Coral chapter, and maybe in every chapter of the book, actually. And I think part of what's interesting about the stories that people told us is what you do with that urgency. And people had a lot of different answers to that question. And so, a lot of the folks that we interviewed have become, very active politically or in trying to influence or inform policymaking. Some folks have become very active in working directly with communities that are being impacted by climate change. So thinking about how we restore and protect and keep sustainable habitats at a community scale. So if we're not yet confronting the global scale of this problem, can we work at smaller scales together? And I think Eric and I found the answers to those questions. What do you do with this feeling of urgency? To be really enlightening, and often they were very hopeful, actually. So oftentimes those stories were sad and heart-wrenching, and then also a glimmer of what that individual is doing to cultivate hope.
Before we say goodbye, I want to talk about one more thing. And it was a chapter that I found, or part of the book I found very moving, was about abalone, and in particular the white abalone that is at the Bodega Marine Lab, being cultivated with some degree of success. And I think we should mention for our listeners that abalone and coral have the type of reproduction that it's like spewing out. It's almost like a proximate thing. And if there just aren't a lot of examples of these animals or specimens in the habitat, then they have a harder time reproducing. But so talk a little bit about abalone and the work that's being done to try to change that.
This story is very close to my heart because it's an initiative that's based at my own institution at Bodega Marine Lab. So that is the work to save the endangered white abalone. And so for your listeners who are within California, I think abalone is something that's so culturally and historically significant to so many Californians and so many indigenous groups. In short, we've loved them to death. So the white abalone in particular was prized as, the tastiest abalone to consume. And so it was listed on the endangered species list because we have caught so many, as you just alluded to, that there's so few in the wild that when they spawn, when they broadcast spawn, which means they sort of, spew the eggs and sperm into the ocean water. There isn't another abalone nearby for those to actually make successful reproduction. So the abalone are so far apart that they are no longer being able to successfully make more abalone in the wild. And so this project, I won't give away the whole story because I want people to read the book and read the story. But I will tell you that this project has been going on at Bodega Marine Lab for quite a while, for over a decade. And I was lucky to be present on a day when they were getting ready for some of these endangered white abalone that they have successfully raised in the lab. So, this group of scientists led by Kristen Aquilino has basically, perfected the art of getting white abalone to reproduce in the lab and live successfully and happily in the lab. So they now have thousands upon thousands of them living in the lab. And I was there on a day when they were preparing some abalone to take a trip to Southern California to be relocated using scuba divers to be put back out into the wild. So these white abalone had lived their whole lives so far in the lab at Bodega, and they were being blessed by multiple different groups of people, including indigenous groups of people who were there to acknowledge the significance of the white abalone, the symbolic and cultural and historical significance of this, but also acknowledge that this was a success story, that the scientists leading this project were actually able to figure out how to do this well and do it right, and that we could, if we put our energy and our resources toward this, we could save a species that was on the brink of extinction. And we chose, that's the last story of the book, and we chose that very intentionally because the final words of the book are actually Dr. Kristen Aquilino basically saying in poetry form, we are saving this species because we are saving ourselves. We are and need to be connected to the environment that we live in, and each species matters. And so showing that we actually can do things to turn something around, that it's not all bad news, that our efforts and our work towards making things better are worth it, is the exact way that we wanted to end the book.
Well, that had me choked up, and I could get choked up even now thinking about it. It was a very powerful way to conclude the book. And as we've been talking about today, the book is ultimately about people and our ability to work together and create the change for the love and respect of this planet we all share. Thank you, Tessa Hill, who, along with Eric Simmons, has written the book At Every Depth.
Thank you so much for speaking with me today.
I've been speaking with Tessa Hill, who, along with Eric Simmons, wrote At Any Depth, Our Growing Knowledge of the Changing Oceans. Their collaboration was so strong that the writing is seamless and it's beautiful to read. Our next guests are collaborators as well. In fact, Josie Islin and Mariana Loischel say, we believe in the power of collaboration. And theirs has brought us a web story, The Mysterious World of Bull Kelp. I am Suzanne Lang, and this is A Novel Idea. We'll take a short break and be back with Josie and Mariana. Above, Below is an ocean literacy campaign to raise awareness about kelp forests on the Pacific coast, and The Mysterious World of Bull Kelp is a web story that can be found online at bullkelp.info and is the centerpiece of that campaign. Josie Islin and Mariana Loischel are its co-directors and the creative forces behind the web story. Josie is a photographer, author, and has created several books, including The Curious World of Seaweed and Ocean Garden, The Secret Life of Seaweed. Beach, A Book of Treasure, among others. Mariana is a communications designer whose new agency develops strategies and campaigns for clients in ocean and land stewardship. They believe in the power of collaboration, and they seek for us to be a part too. Here's our conversation.
You two have collaborated, and something you say is that you believe in the power of collaboration. And how did your collaboration over this particular issue come to be, and in this form?
Well, I'll begin. I have been thinking about seaweed and kelp for a long time. My book, The Curious World of Seaweed, was my second book on seaweed and kelp, and it came out in 2019 from Heyday Books. And the second chapter is all about bull kelp, the iconic canopy-forming kelp of our California coast, but also the dominant kelp all the way up through the Pacific Northwest through Alaska. And in writing that chapter, that second chapter, it was when there was really a steep decline in kelp here in California, and it was becoming an issue that hadn't yet surfaced as much as it has now. And I knew I wanted to continue a deeper dive into the bull kelp story. And just about at the time when I was thinking I would be writing another book, and that book project wasn't really gelling, it wasn't coming to be, Mariana got in touch with me. And it's just been this incredibly wonderful, productive, organic collaboration that has given rise to this web story. So Mariana, you can take it from there.
Yes, my background is actually in land stewardship. I ran a design studio, communications design studio in Sausalito for 20 years. And I didn't really know about this issue of the loss of kelp on our coast, on the North Coast. I also live part-time in Mendocino. And I decided about three years ago to turn my attention to the oceans. And I met Josie. And since that time, we have been collaborating as co-directors of what we call Above Below, which is an ocean literacy campaign to raise awareness about kelp forests across the whole Northeastern Pacific. And this web story, The Mysterious World of Bull Kelp, is the centerpiece of our campaign currently.
So you have both done substantial work in these areas, graphically, informationally, in the past. And now we have this web story that is beautiful, and the writing is so evocative. It draws you in right away, so that the words and the pictures and the navigation through the site all feels very smooth and easy. So I guess I'm wondering about the development of this platform to communicate and some of the design decisions and the informational decisions of how do you present information that flows and that people don't get lost or buried too deeply in the site.
I think we want to emphasize that this format, this kind of deep dive web story, which really is a web-based book, is pretty unique. The use of design to take us into these kind of deeper chunks of information about the kelp forest. So we took a deeper dive, and I've been, as a writer, it's really my mission to tease out the ecological stories that are evocative, synthesizing all of the scientific papers and experts that I've been talking to, and tease out the stories that are interesting. And then between Mariana and I, having this visual take to keep those stories flowing has been really, really an incredible. So my job is kind of the writing and the teasing out of the stories. And then I'll send it over to Mariana, because she really brings this incredible design, kind of project management team, which has just been incredible.
Yes, I brought my creative team together for this project. We've worked together for many, many years on other campaigns. And so together, we did really create this concept for what we're calling a web story. And in some ways, I was really the audience for this kind of an idea to bring a comprehensive story. Since I'm new to the oceans, I couldn't find one place where I can learn about the ecosystem. I could find articles at our point in time about specific issues or specific regions or specific organizations that are working on kelp research and restoration and recovery. But there wasn't one place that I could go to learn about it all. And that was our real goal, was to bring all this information into one place as a hub of all things bull kelp.
Yeah, keeping algal-centric has been a kind of ongoing mission of mine. And it's not that there aren't really interesting human stories. The human, you know, humans are one of the characters in the kelp forest community. But really trying to say, what can we not only learn about bull kelp, but learn from it? How can we take this deep dive into its world to gain respect for this incredible organism of our oceans that we know so little about, and really build a level of understanding so that when this information does come at us from the newspaper, from radio shows, from magazine articles, that is all about either the crisis in California or kelp farming or all sorts of other issues that are presented to us, how do we have the contextual knowledge to really understand how to assess all that information? So that was our goal, and to do it beautifully. We're designers, we're artists at heart. So having that level of visual delight is super, super important to us. And being able to work with Ellen Litwiller, the illustrator that did the homepage for us and the individual character icons, was just a fabulous, fabulous collaboration. She's just a wonderful scientific illustrator and artist. She lives and works right here in Muir Beach, and that was very much a part of this collaboration.
Well, there's also, in order to present this kind of information, as you've just alluded to, blend the scientific, the linguistic, I'll say, the cultural, and all not afraid to use scientific language, but kind of almost naturalizing it in a way so that we could understand the anatomy of a bull kelp, as well as how it moves in the ocean and how light filters through it. But this complex ecosystem that we have maybe misunderstood for many years. Part of what I think you're saying that I loved is that we have our own language, but there are other languages and cultural understandings that might open this up for us.
Yes, you've touched on a number of things that were really deliberate on our part. When I'm writing, one of my goals is to build vocabulary. So how can words like detritivore, one of my favorite words, the abalone and the sea urchin are all detritivores. What does that mean? Well, that's really one of the basic concepts of the kelp forest. They eat the detritus of the kelp that floats down. So building that kind of sense of wonder through language is very much part of my writing process. And then we very much did go out to tribes and really try to build a kind of a database of words for bull kelp itself, to say, this is not something that we only know in the English language. There's this whole variety of ways to relate to this organism, to have relationships that are different from perhaps our own Western orientation to this organism. And those different relationships are extremely important. And we have a lot to learn in terms of our future relationship to the ocean in general, and how we can kind of build resilience back into these systems. Because one of the things we've been aware of is that we've been mining resilience out of our ocean systems for so long. So part of the purpose of this web story is to present the full story of kelp forest abundance and what are some of the issues that have caused so much stress on it.
And I would add to that the mission of Above Below from the outset was to bring art and science together to tell this story. And of course, Josie's been doing that for many years through her beautiful books, which were really was my first entree into understanding and learning about seaweeds in general and bull kelp in particular. But the reason we named our campaign Above Below is that we really wanted to help people connect their love of forests on land with the forests of the ocean. Most of us never have the chance to experience them, as you describe, with the sunlight filtering through. We might see bull kelp washed up on shore, the kelp rack, but we don't have the, you know, the ability to understand what is happening under the surface of the ocean. So that is one of the reasons that we bring art into this storytelling. And in addition to this web story, we also have hosted a number of art exhibits that bring people together through kelp-centric art. And then we share the science and the stories about restoration with them. So it's been a very effective way at bringing this story to more people.
You know, I have to say, when I was going through the site, I was wishing that I was a 12-year-old having to write a report for school, you know, because it was so much good information that was really presented in such an accessible way. So I am sure that it's a resource for lots of young people as well to just learn what's going on and understand what they're seeing when they go to the beach.
I'd just like to make a shout out to all of the teachers that have already gotten in touch with us, but any other teachers, we have posters we can send for classrooms, but we really have gotten a really wonderful response from educators of all sorts. The website has already been distributed to state park docents to use with their educational programs, national park docents as well. As well as classroom teachers from middle school all the way through high school. So that is really our heart's desire, is for it to be used in that way that you just mentioned, Suzanne. So any educators are out there, please be in touch with us through the website. It's our delight to correspond.
Wonderful. What a pleasure to visit the mysterious world of kelp, a web story, and its creators are Josie Islin and Mariana Loischel, and I thank you so much for talking with us today about it.
Thank you, Suzanne.
Thank you. It's been wonderful.
Josie Islin and Mariana Loischel of Above Below with their web story, The Mysterious World of Bull Kelp, which you can dive into online at bullkelp.info. Earlier, we spoke with Tessa Hill, who along with Eric Simmons has given us their book, At Every Depth. I thank my guests. Their collaborations give us tools and resources to be more connected with how we impact our oceans and the life there, and how we can be more connected with each other as we seek to live responsibly and sustainably into the future. We have a couple of past shows you might be interested in with Anne Velisis on abalone and Susan Hand Shetterly on seaweed. You can find those and many others at norcalpublicmedia.org. Follow the program or podcast links. I am Suzanne Lang, and I have production assistance from Mark Prell, Kelly Olson, Max Allen, and Will Penny. Our theme music is Nocturne from Peter Jacobson. We are a production of Lit Radio and Northern California Public Media. Listen to past shows and subscribe to our podcast at norcalpublicmedia.org. Thank you for listening. It's a novel idea.